The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. I like to think of this as an empowerment hour, because I will be sharing insights and information for myself and guests that, for most people, even people who listen regularly, will be new and hopefully useful. For example, my guest in the third segment of our program today will be Professor Nasir Ghami. He is a professor of psychiatry specializing in depression-related disorders at Tufts University Medical School, and he's also on the faculty of Harvard Medical School. What makes this particular guest interesting is that he is claiming, and we will see how he evolves his argument, that many of our leaders are nuts. In other words, they're suffering from illnesses, but we don't want a really mentally sound leader. In effect, he believes that George Bush was healthy mentally. He says that we need leaders who are mad. Really? Okay, well, let's give him the benefit of a doubt. We'll have in our environmental section the clothes that you're wearing could be toxic. From our issues segment, we're going to put forth a simple hypothesis. There's a new report in England from Alex Howes from The Guardian that gives a completely different reason why they had those recent riots. Really interesting. And that'll be our issue of the day, along with this. It seems though then head of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, wanted to keep the housing bubble descent top secret. This just came out. I'll share that with you. And then what should we do with this information then once we have it? Also, good news. Beyond Franken Foods and Toxics, 10 Reasons to Buy Organic Food from Ronnie Cummins from Common Dreams. Bob Burnett, 5 Reasons Capitalism Has Failed from The Smirking Chimp. And Paul Rodriguez, 1 in 4 children in California are hungry. Their families can't afford food. That's a whole lot of hungry children. New information. We always begin our program with the latest on original peer-reviewed literature on health and healing. And this ties into something that I was speaking with a group of physicians recently in Chicago while I was filming. This is from Science Daily. And it says, most U.S. physicians will face malpractice claims, but risk of making payment is low, analysts find. There's an article in the current issue of the New England Journal of Medicine that provides the most comprehensive analysis of the risk of malpractice claims by physicians, especially in more than 2 decades, and finds that the annual chance of that a claim varies from 5% low risk to 20%, which is very high and the highest risk. Now, let's jump over to Chicago. I was a keynote presenter at the World Congress on Anti-Aging Medicine. I was presenting a paper based upon a clinical study I had done on over 250 women to see was it possible to change their biochemistry and therefore reverse many of the symptoms of menopause that was creating discomfort, weight gain, thyroid imbalances, hair loss, mood swings, insomnia, urinary incontinence, repeated bladder infections, loss of muscle mass, the abdominal fat spreading, thickening and flaking, speckling of the nails, fungus, all these things, hot flashes and night sweats and thinning of the bones that go on in most women who go through menopause. The study found that you could reverse literally all that, and we did. But while I was doing this, I asked at the end of my talk, were there any physicians in the room who would be willing to go on camera and give me their perspective of what needed to change in medicine? And then I left the stage, and about 400 or 500 showed up outside. There are about 7,000 in the actual room. So many that I took a room, a suite, set up a camera, and it was packed. Two of the biggest concerns of these physicians were that there was a failure of American medicine to recognize the significance in natural non-invasive therapies. And this was best illustrated by a woman from San Francisco. She was both an MD, PhD, graduate of Harvard, and impeccable background. But she said on camera, and you'll see that in an upcoming film, that she was leaving medicine. She was only 40. Why are you leaving medicine? She said, well, there's several reasons, not the least of which is that my malpractice insurance is so high that I can't afford it. At the end of the year, I literally am struggling to make just basic payments, like a mortgage payment or buy food. She said, I never thought after so many years in medicine that I would literally be one step away from not having any cash at all. And she said so, and nothing's being done to change this. Separately, she frequently gets checks for as little as a penny. And I said, why would anyone give you a check for a penny? The insurance companies. She said, because there's no denomination less than a penny. I said, but what did you do that they felt allowed you to deserve only 1 cent? And she said, it was simple. I provided an hour and a half of therapy and time and consultation with a patient, but explaining to them how they could overcome their conditions using natural non-toxic therapies. The insurance companies, when I submitted this, chose to say this isn't covered, and hence they wouldn't give me anything. I then turned around and I asked other people who were packed in the room, has this happened to any of you? Every single hand went up. I wasn't aware of this. I then asked this question of each one of the hundreds of physicians I filmed that day, night, and the next day. How many of you have considered giving up medicine because it is so litigious? Every single person said the same thing. So here is a suggestion, and this generally is not in the consciousness of many Americans. We need physicians, and we need good medicine. I'm not opposed to drugs. I'm opposed to overused or bad drugs or drugs that are used when there's a natural and more beneficial treatment instead of the drug. We are overusing medical tests. We're doing too many diagnostics for a simple reason. When you walk into a hospital or a physician's office or clinic, there is always the thought that you're going to be the one who's going to sue them and win. And if by any chance the insurance companies show that you have not done something, they can then decide and have that they're not going to cover you. It's your negligence. And then you could go bankrupt. Why don't we just have no-fault insurance, health insurance? So no doctor, nurse, or hospital or clinic can be sued. If you should sustain an injury, and people will, their treatment will be free. If they lose work, whatever they would have been making at their work will be covered. And that's it. No punitive damages. Then have every physician and hospital put a small percentage of their income into a general nonprofit fund that then covers those people where there are injuries. But that also means that the doctor no longer has to pay that malpractice insurance. Three things are going to happen. A, the cost of medical care will drop by about $100 to $200 billion a year. Secondly, you're not going to be subjected to unnecessary tests where they want to cover the basis. Defensive medicine is called. Third, now that you're not going to be able to take advantage, as a lot of Americans do, we're a highly litigious society, then it means also that in that process, you'll be able to spend more quality time with the physician. So it can only help us. We have no car and no fault car insurance. It doesn't matter who caused the wreck. You know, it'll be covered, but then you can't go out of your way to sue someone and then walk around with a back brace or neck brace, for a year until you make sure no one's watching. There are legitimate injuries, and there's an awful lot of fraud. In fact, last year, Medicare and Medicaid, over $300 billion in fraud. Enormous numbers in fraud at all levels. So that's one way to clean up the system, improve healthcare delivery, and ensure that we're not going to have a mass exodus of physicians who start leaving because they're afraid of losing lawsuits. That's a thought. Then I also believe that we should completely scrap the existing healthcare plan that we have, which is a complete and total fraud, and anyone who actually reads the details will understand it. First, what is the whole point of the exercise? Well, there are several points. One is to make sure that no one's left out of being helped if they have an emergency. Well, right now they can go to hospitals, emergency rooms, but that's the small end of it. What if a person has a catastrophic illness like cancer or multiple sclerosis or Alzheimer's or Parkinson's? Those people go broke. Did anyone pay attention that for over 12 years, either the number one or two cause of bankruptcy, all bankruptcy in the United States, was not failed businesses? It was couldn't afford the medical coverage with a major illness. You get yourself into that cycle, and you have to pay or are responsible for paying for a lot of those bills. It can run you $200,000, $300,000, $500,000. Autism can run you at least $150,000 a year. So we're not really helping those people under the existing plan. But we haven't even answered a basic question. Do we have the knowledge, skills, and techniques now to prevent 90% of all illnesses? If you can prevent an illness, and if you could carry on a national educational program right down to the schools and kindergarten and preschool that would help people understand cause and effect, that could save $1 trillion a year, and all that suffering would be saved. We have no such program now at all. Nothing. And in fact, the only thing we have is the pink march for breast cancer, but then that's all fraud because, A, it doesn't prevent breast cancer, and B, the people sponsoring it are the people who make tamoxifen, the drug that actually causes a 300% increase in cancer in women of color. It's all about the money. And foundations that live forever by giving a tiny little fraction of what they get into some public service and keeping the rest of it for their great paychecks and their nice big suites and all their galas. So we've got to stop lying to ourselves. The very first thing we should do with the health care plan is get people healthy. Wouldn't you think? I mean, someone somewhere in Congress would say, you know, our health care plan, shouldn't it actually involve health? And someone goes, duh, dummy, why should it involve health? Well, because it's called healthcare. And it has nothing to do with healthcare. It has to do with making sure the insurance industry, which is already one of the most profitable industries in America, has a captive audience. And so they're going to get all the rest of these. So that's what it's about. So I see it's about making money. Yes, it's about making money for the pharmaceutical industry and the insurance industry and the for-profit hospital industry. Well, why couldn't we have a national preventative health care program? Why couldn't we then offer a choice? You want private insurance, you can have it, but if you don't want private insurance or can't afford it, you can also be covered in a program similar to what, let's say, similar to a Medicare program for those 40 to 60 million Americans who have not the financial means to do it either. That shows, A, we have compassion as a society, and that's going to run us about $60 billion a year. $60 billion is a lot of money, yes, but compared to what? That's not even 1 week in Iraq and Afghanistan. And what do we get for being in Afghanistan and Iraq for a week? A lot of death, destruction, and depleted uranium that's there forever. Destroyed infrastructure, hate, and animosity. Nothing to benefit. So, but what if you had as mandatory, anyone who gets free insurance must take courses? Okay, you want it free? Fine. You're going through a rough time? We understand. We're a compassionate country. What's your responsibility? Understand that you've got to make lifestyle choices. You can't have it both ways. I don't believe that you should be given something that requires no responsibility for the choices you make. Others will say, well, isn't it a person's right to make any choice they want? And I say, absolutely. But if you want to smoke and drink and do things that are going to cause you to create disease, why then should I be responsible for helping you overcome that? At a certain point in any society, we must hold a standard and ask, here are the tools you need to be healthy. If you want my help, then at least let's put this into place. Let's have classes. Let's have courses at every level. The largest single expense in America today, more than twice as big as defense, more than housing and food, education and clothing, is health care. This year it will reach over $2.6 trillion. How much of that could be saved? If you had no-fault health care, $200 billion. If you eliminated the high price on Medicaid and Medicare and VA drugs and therefore allowed hospitals and clinics to buy generic brands, $300 billion. If you had a single-payer health insurance for those who couldn't afford it and therefore you didn't have a high administration cost, which is about 28 to 31% out of every dollar, you could do it for under 1%, another $200 billion. And suddenly, gee whiz, you've just saved almost $1 trillion. Right there. Plus, you get a nation healthier. You see, the answers are not complicated. For those of us who are in the field helping people every single day, every year, we see what works and we see what doesn't work. So we take the best of what works within orthodox medicine, which is about 12%, and we leave everything else be. That's right, only 12% of any medical practices currently being used have been tested for safety and efficacy by any gold standard, and the vast majority don't work. In fact, not only do they not work, they are actually the number one cause of death and injury every single year in the United States. They exceed cancer, stroke, and heart disease. Not a single thing is done to address this. No meetings, no discussions, no debates, nothing. What does that say about us as being open and vital and wanting positive change and wanting a good outcome for people? If we wanted that, we wouldn't have been given all this chemotherapy to all these people because they don't have the science to back it up. I've studied all the scientific literature on chemotherapy. They have a massive failure rate. Yet they continue to walk around like the emperor with no clothes. That's some thoughts. Next up, what can we do to help prevent fractures and osteoporosis? According to Florida State University researchers, it's very simple. A proactive solution to help fractures and osteoporosis, eat dried plums. That's it. Dried plums. The state's Margaret Seitzen, professor and chairman of the Department of Nutrition and Food and Exercise Sciences, said, quote, all fruits and vegetables have a positive effect on nutrition, but in terms of bone health, prunes are exceptional. You bet. How about 3 to 4 prunes in the morning? That'll help those 8 million women who otherwise are suffering from that. One other thing we could be using that is very good for men with enlarged prostate that would help prevent prostate problems, whole ginger extract. Now, in a first-of-its-kind study assessing anti-cancer properties of ginger as a whole instead of the plant's individual components, scientists at Georgia State University have discovered that whole ginger extract has promising cancer-preventing activity in prostate cancer. They published in the British Journal of Nutrition, and the professor and Jaya discovered that ginger extract significantly stopped the growth of cancer cells, as well as inducing cell death in a spectrum of prostate cancer cells. In addition, animal studies revealed that the extract did not show significant toxicity because there's nothing toxic in ginger, nor did it adversely affect the bone marrow. In fact, it revealed very good tumor regression, up to 60%, and no toxicity whatsoever. So let's just add another peer-reviewed journal done in a major university showing something as simple and expensive and healthy as whole ginger. Now, how do I suggest you take it? in the morning when you're making your juice and you're putting in the beets and the grapes and the apple, throw in a whole piece of ginger, probably about a 2-inch piece. That'll help you tremendously. And finally, on our health line here, this is a study by Dr. David Jockers, and they're talking about what they discovered when they took a look at A1 beta casein. And dairy products, as we know, are one of the most common foods consumed around the world. And some cultures have a higher percentage of raw cow and goats and sheep's milk in their diet. But in the Western world, dairy has become one of the most inflammatory foods. A recent discovery shows that a genetic shift in the casein molecule has produced a powerful toxin linked to numerous disorders and diseases. Milk contains two primary protein molecules, whey and casein. Casein makes up about 80% of the protein in the milk. Now, casein is made up of 209 amino acids strung together in sequence. The two primary forms of casein are A1 beta casein and A2 beta casein. These two are nearly identical in structure except for the amino acid at position 67. A1 contains histidine while A2 contains proline. And what they found was that now with the changes in how dairy is produced, that you're getting a passing through of the BCM7, passes into the bloodstream, is able to cross the blood-brain barrier, and in the brain it can bind to opioid receptors and cause symptoms of schizophrenia, autism, and other mood and neurodevelopmental issues. So, my suggestion, there's no need for us to have dairy in our diet at all. So, become like myself and others, vegan, or at least go off of dairy. By the way, older adults with too much salt in the diet and too little exercise, you're at a greater risk of cognitive decline. And that's not difficult because at this particular Institute of Montreal at McGill University study and the University of Sherbrooke, they found that high salt diets coupled with low exercise, you really end up with a accelerated deterioration of brain function and cognitive problems. So, and this was published in the Quebec Longitudinal Study on Nutrition and Successful Aging. So I suggest that we pay some attention to what we're doing. We don't need all that salt. We just don't. There's so many other wonderful ways of using lime, lemon, apple cider vinegar, balsamic vinegar. No need for it. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Unfortunately, the songwriter and performer there died today. Used to come in the health food store and have juices. So did Isaac Hayes. He in fact even had a Isaac Hayes green juice there that he'd come in every night and get. Sorry to see that such a talented and loving person has left us. A couple of things, then we're going to go to our guest who's standing by. Two issues for you today. This one is from The Guardian, from Alec Hawks, and it's short, but think on this for a moment. The United Kingdom riots were products of consumerism. Analyst reports points to deeply flawed social ethos and calls for shift of emphasis from material to non-material values. I'll quote this. The recent riots in London and other big cities were the product of an out-of-control consumerist ethos, which will have profound impact on the UK economy. And the report by Tullet Prebon warns, quote, the consumerist ethos in which a materialist vision is both peddled and, for the vast majority, simultaneously ruled out by exclusion, has extremely damaging consequences, both social and economic. The report, the first global head of research, Tim Morton, went into great detail on this. He said, we conclude that one of the reasons for the rioting reflects a deeply flawed economic and social ethos, recklessly borrowed consumption, the breakdown both of top-end accountability and of trust in institutions, and severe failings by government over more than two decades. The underlying message of the advertising and marketing industries and huge budgets are devoted to pushing a message which, updated, is I buy, therefore I am. And then the message is typical. A typical internet user sees hundreds of advertisements per day. And the underlying message of all these is, here's the ideal. Oh, you can't have it. Accompanying this is an inflation of government and private debt. The economy has been subject to repeated boom and bust cycles. But above and beyond everything, most of the places that were robbed and burned down were people took items they wanted. So it's a few pieces of the puzzle to consider. This is more disturbing to me. This is a short piece. We were told, and this is from the Huffington Post, Ryan Grimm. We were told, of course, if you watched the hearings, that I didn't know there was a housing bubble. How could I know? Well, you were head of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, and not only that, but gee whiz, you had unlimited amounts of resources to determine there was a housing bubble. So he got a get-out-of-jail-free pass, as did all of the people at Treasury and all the major banks, as if we didn't know. Let me quote this. As top Federal Reserve officials debated whether there was a housing bubble and what to do about it, then-Chairman Alan Greenspan argued that dissent should be kept secret so that the Fed wouldn't lose control of the debate to people anywhere else. Quote, we run the risk by laying out the pros and cons of a particular argument of inducing people to join in on the debate. And in this regard, it is possible to lose control of the process that only we understand. Alan Greenspan at a March meeting. At the same time, a Federal Reserve Bank president from Atlanta, Jack Guin, warned, quote, a number of the folks are expressing growing concern about potential overbuilding and worrisome speculation in the real estate markets, especially in Florida. Entire condo projects and upscale residential lots are being pre-sold before any construction, with buyers freely admitting they have no intention of occupying the units or building on the land, but rather on counting on flipping the properties, selling quickly at higher fees. Had Gwynn's warning been heeded and the housing market cooled, the financial collapse 2008 could have been avoided. But his comment was kept secret until just this Friday, when the central bank released the transcripts of Federal Open Market Committee meetings, and the transcript was there. Quote, the substantial run-up in house prices, which we have followed in Florida and also see in the populous Northeast and West Coast of the United States, may at least partially be attributable to unusually low mortgage rates influenced by a very accommodative policy. But when the Federal Reserve turned over minutes of the meeting, it downplayed anything this man had to say. So here's the bottom line. Here's the most, one of the most powerful, well, the most powerful group of individuals. You can't say that the Federal Reserve is a governmental agency, because it's not. It's quasi. But anyone who disagreed with Alan Greenspan, keeping the interest rates very low to allow all this massive bubble, speculative borrowing, was excluded. So, should he be held accountable? Should we continue to allow this lack of transparency and honesty, not just at the Fed, but in all these other government agencies? I'm Gary Noll. Your thoughts on this? Our number to call in, 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. And we're going to go to our guest in just about 30 seconds. But from the board's report, Gaddafi found running for a Republican nomination. This just in from Concord, New Hampshire. The mystery surrounding Colonel Gaddafi's whereabouts was resolved today as the dictator announced his candidacy for the Republican presidential nomination in the town hall meeting in Concord, New Hampshire. In announcing his candidacy, the Libyan madman joins a Republican field which is believed to be numbering in excess of 700 candidates. While some New Hampshire Republicans seem surprised to see Colonel Gaddafi shaking hands and kissing babies at the Concord Town Hall, an aide to the Libyan strongman said his transformation to the GOP candidate made perfect sense. Quote, in those final days in Tripoli, he was becoming increasingly disconnected from reality. So I think he fits right into the Republican Party. Mr. Gaddafi, dressed in his trademark yellow turban and matching robe, got mixed reviews in his first appearance on the campaign trail, with some New Hampshire citizens saying that his six-hour stump speech was a tad long. Additionally, some felt that his rhetoric needed to be toned down, especially his closing line about fighting for the Republican nomination, quote, until the last drop of blood. But others gave him high marks for his grasp of history and geography, which most agreed was stronger than Michelle Bachmann's. Perhaps underscoring the challenges that lie ahead for Mr. Gaddafi in his quest for the GOP nod, current polls show him in the back of the pack leading former Senator Rick Santorum but trailing the pizza guy. Unfortunately for Mr. Gaddafi, he might be out of step with the current crop of Republican candidates. One pollster said there's a perception that he's too moderate. I'm Gary Noll. Time now to say hello to our guest. We'll be back in just a second. Well, let's just go right over to him now. Let's say hello again. I gave the introduction and his background earlier. Dr. Nasir Ghami, nice to have you with us today.
Hi, Gary. Nice to be with you.
You've laid out some interesting hypothesis, and we'd like to explore it and have you take the time in full context to let us know how you're thinking and how you evolve these concepts. So the first area is we need some definitions, particularly what you mean by the inverse law of sanity. And you have identified four mental illnesses which enhance leadership characteristics rather than impair them. So please briefly describe each with a couple of historical examples, okay?
Okay, thank you, Gary. I am a psychiatrist. I do treatment and research with patients with depression and bipolar disorder. I also have degrees in history and philosophy and interest in those topics, which got me into looking at historical leaders from that perspective. The mental illness in particular associated with benefits for crisis leadership is mania and depression, which can happen in the same person in manic depression or bipolar disorder. And sometimes people only have the depression part. The other two aspects, the other main aspect that I talk about in the book is hyperthymic temperament, which means manic symptoms that are mild and belong to one's personality. One could also have dysthymic temperament, which is depressive symptoms, which are mild and are part of one's personality. Technically, those aren't mental illnesses. They're actually biologically and genetically related to having the mental illnesses of severe depression and mania, but when they're mild, they can be just part of one's temperament or personality. So what I discuss in First Rate Madness is the scientific research that shows that there's a good deal of evidence supporting benefits to depression and mania to some extent, especially when depression and mania are mild or moderate. With depression, for instance, when present to a mild degree, people are shown to be more realistic in their assessment of their control over the environment than normal, non-depressed subjects. Also, people who have depression in the past or currently, in research studies looking at scales of empathy, have higher amounts of empathy than normal subjects. In people with mania, studies show that they have greater creativity in tests of creativity than normal subjects. And in people with mild manic symptoms as part of that hyperthymic temperament, studies of post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD show that people with hyperthymic temperament, after they experience a trauma, are much less likely to develop PTSD. In other words, they are resilient to trauma. So these four traits, resilience, realism, creativity, and empathy, are shown to be associated with these conditions. And then what I did was to show that these conditions are present in many of our historical leaders who seem to have these traits. And I argue that this is not a coincidence, and that what applies to the majority of people in scientific studies should also apply to historical figures, that they are not somehow superhuman, they are in fact human.
All right, I appreciate the overview. I want to probe this deeper. We're just trying to get our mind around your complex ideas. Both Gandhi and Martin Luther King attempted suicide when they were young, and both had serious bouts of depression later in life. You refer to the depressive realism hypothesis, which you just briefly mentioned, which is basically that depressed people can see reality more clearly than normal, and happy people who are more prone to distort reality. So I would like you to go into this in more detail and explain why it is that we find privileged leaders, particularly among corporate executives, who we call the best and brightest, also being the people most removed from being empathetic towards the plights of people. And I'll give you two examples. Using your model of creative, empathetic, resilient, and realistic, right? Those are your four.
That's right.
When I look at most corporate leaders, I see only resilience. For example, George Bush believed that he could win a war in Iraq, and that ended up, and he should have known at the time because he didn't have the truth on his side, but he was never realistic, and he had no empathy either for the citizens killed or all the people who would stay permanently disabled suffering from Gulf War syndrome as well as post-traumatic stress disorder. The only time he ever went to the hospital is when he had to, and there was zero creativity. There was never any how can we deal with the war on terrorism by any other means, including communications, changing the living environment, changing the imbalance of power in people who have lived under repressive regimes. None of that came into his mindset, but nor is it coming to Obama's mindset, nor Clinton's mindset, nor Bush Sr.'s mindset, nor Reagan's mindset. So I'm asking, how then can we suggest that these people would have made good leaders when you look at the consequences of their leadership, and America is one enormous crisis right now? Your thoughts, please.
Well, the other aspect of saying that there are some benefits to some of these mental illnesses, and again, I'm not talking about all mental illnesses, and I'm not discussing schizophrenia or severe symptoms, but some benefits to mild or moderate symptoms of these conditions. The flip side to it is that there are some limitations to mental health, to not having any of these symptoms at all, to being completely sane, one might say. And what I what I tried to describe is that George W. Bush, for instance, does not have any history in his background of severe depression or severe mania. He does not have any evidence of extreme personality traits like the hyperthymic temperament. The things that people often raise to suggest that he's somehow abnormal is mainly his alcoholism, which happens in about 15% or more of the population. And he stopped his drinking without any treatment or any consequence, which doesn't happen 95% of the time. So his alcoholism is not in itself really suggestive of much abnormality, and the absence of all the other symptoms of mental illness argue for primarily mental health. And if we agree that he has all these political limitations, it seems to me that it makes sense that the two things are connected. The scientific research shows that mentally healthy people have fewer of these traits. Now, there are some benefits to mental health, though. In times of non-crisis, peace and prosperity, like when George Bush got elected president in 2000 and we had a surplus and no major wars, at those times, people choose an average person who they want to have a beer with. And that's how he got elected president. And when the crisis comes, though, such people who can keep the clocks running and keep the trains going when things are normal are not able to face new circumstances creatively or empathically or realistically.
All right. But look at the other side of that. Are you suggesting then that Gandhi and Martin Luther King would have made better leaders than most of the leaders we have today, either corporate leaders or government leaders?
Well, they would not have made better leaders in times of normal prosperity, but they make better leaders in times of crisis. And I think this is a reflected in the biographies of these leaders that I discuss in First-Rate Madness. They generally are not in positions of power. They're not successful when everything is going well. Churchill, for instance, was in the wilderness during the 1920s and into the 1930s, had no political influence at all. Sherman was bankrupt and had no military career at all before the Civil War, General William Sherman. But when the crises come, that's when these leaders are most successful. Same thing with businessmen. The businessmen who are corporate leaders who just need to keep everything going as it is when the past predicts the future do fine when the past predicts the future, when everything is pretty stable. But when there's an economic crisis, those people happen to be at the top because they were there when the things were going well. That's when a new group of leaders is needed, and there's always a delay, a time lag for these people to become apparent and available to either the voting public or to the business, and for people to turn to them.
Okay, I understand that. That makes sense, and I appreciate you sharing that. Now let's look at something that's current in today. This is from Raul Rodriguez from New America Media. It says, 1 in 4 California families cannot afford for their kids food. I'll quote this from San Francisco. 1 in 4 California households with children reported food hardships. This is according to Food Research and Action Center. Quote, it's disturbing but not surprising. What you have there is you have many times in the past 12 months, there was not enough money to buy food and your family needed that food. You simply went hungry. Now, when you start adding up how many this total comes to in all of America, we're looking at approximately 17 million American children who on a weekly basis do not have all the nutrition they require. And school teachers all over America are telling me that kids come to school, they can't focus, they have no energy, and they're too embarrassed to admit that they didn't have breakfast and possibly not even dinner the night before. Here's my question. Last week, last Wednesday, I was in southern Jersey in a very affluent county. It does not even have one single shelter. Not one, zero. And I went 100 feet off the road, and I came to a tent city. The tent city was overseen by this pastor, and who tried to keep a sense of organization and orderliness. The food, the only food they could get, was at 12:30 at night. A man would volunteer, go around to 5 pizza places, bring them the pizza that didn't get sold that day, and they would then have that as their food the next day. I filmed in all these people. There were some people on alcohol who were alcoholics or some drug addicts, but the average person there was just a regular person, and they didn't know how to get out of that. Now, if we really had a nation of people who cared about one another and had compassion and empathy, wouldn't we do something to look at what's happening here at home to those who are in need and whose basic just survival needs are not being met? We have, as of today, I don't know if you're aware of this, we have 10.2 million people have lost their homes, families, 4 people per family, that's 42 million Americans are couch surfing. We have 19 million hungry children, and yet nothing is being done for all these people. What does this tell you based upon your concept of who makes a good leader in times of peace, who makes a good leader in times of war or crisis? What kind of leader do we need now to help to go into these areas instead of a leader that goes off to play golf and instead of going out to California and being in those soup kitchens or going to New Jersey and visiting these places and showing people, if nothing else, that you have some empathy for them, even if you may not in that moment at that day change the circumstances of their lives, at least you're not disconnected from them and living this dilettante life that both Democrats and Republicans seem to glory in Washington. Your thoughts, please.
Absolutely, Gary. I'm very sympathetic to what you're saying. You know, in some of my research on empathy and depression, I've came to the conclusion that Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi practiced a politics of radical empathy, that their nonviolent resistance grew out of this, their deep emotional personal experience with depression, leading them to feel very empathic towards those around them. And this translated in their politics into this really unique way of thinking that goes against the grain of human nature. They were realistic. They realized that most people are aggressive and violent. That's why they weren't pacifists. Both Gandhi and King said that when the options were passive acquiescence or violent resistance, they preferred violent resistance to injustice. But they preferred nonviolent resistance even more. And that involved taking the aggression and the evil that's out there in the world and trying to transform it through loving one's enemies, through not trying to defeat them, but to get them to see a different perspective. This is the empathy view. Gandhi once said that that two-thirds of the miseries and misunderstandings of the world would disappear if we could put ourselves in our enemies' shoes. So that's what they thought, but if you look at what they did, and they're obviously admired, and they're viewed as successful in a way, Dr. King achieving desegregation, Gandhi helping achieve independence in India. But they also failed because Dr. King wanted to cure racism. That was his goal. He used the medical metaphor of psychiatry for the disease of racism as the purpose of the civil rights movement, not just changing the voting rights laws. And he partially achieved that, but obviously we still have a long way to go. He also wanted to fight poverty in a very deep way, bordering on socialism. And that was obviously opposed. He strongly opposed the Vietnam War when most of the liberal democratic establishment supported it, and he was a pariah for that. He opposed American intervention abroad. And that's not happening these days the way he, I think, wanted it, certainly in the way he described it in relation to the issues of his day. The problem, I think, partly is that the empathy that these depressive leaders have is unique to them because of many aspects, their spirituality, certainly, but also their depression, whereas the majority of the population, most of us, who are not very depressed, don't see the rest of the world as empathically. We can't go that far in empathizing with others, whether it's poor or people in other countries. And so we don't really follow up. We can't follow these kinds of leaders as far as they want to go in their politics of radical empathy. I think at some level it's a difficulty with human nature.
I really commend you in challenging the current way of examining who makes a good leader or not. It still has to roil around in my mind for a while and to see what I'm going to come up with. And I'm going to invite you back for part two after I've given it some deeper thought, if you don't mind.
No, certainly, Gary. I really appreciate that you're going to think about it more and we can discuss it more.
Yeah, because I don't want to get into it now, but coming into my mind right now are all of the different suffragettes, the people, Carrie Nation and Susan B. Anthony and Mother Jones, all those that headed groups, what they were like, what the movement was like, what its strengths and weaknesses were. And also, I want to talk about Nazism in our next discussion, because it was shown that at the Nuremberg trials, unlike Hitler, most of the defendants were considered mentally healthy. And
that's
so
right.
Then we have to ask, was Nazism an aberration of the sick minds of a few men in a weird place, or was it something that could happen anywhere and could still happen in the future? So, and I also want to bring in the thoughts of the great Sheldon Mollen, professor emeritus of political science, one of the world's unquestionably most brilliant political historians, and he's convincingly shown the U.S. has entered a political state he calls inverted totalitarianism that can lead to the American population surrendering their individual freedoms in order to accept a fascist order in order to feel secure and protected. So I'd like in the future our conversation for us to look at what happens when we fail to look at our own internal mechanisms of surrendering our rights and sovereign states of mind for this so-called utopian state of national security bliss.
Okay, well, that sounds like it'll be a great discussion.
Good. Well, I thank you very much for the work. The book is called A First Rate Madness, Uncovering the Links Between Leadership and Mental Illness. My guest, a professor of psychiatry specializing in depression-related disorders, Tufts University Medical School, and director of the Mood Disorders Program at Tufts Boston Medical Center, and serves on the faculty of Harvard Medical School, Dr. Nasir Ghami, G-H-A-M-I-M-I. Thank you very much, sir, for being with us.
Thank you, Gary. It was great to talk to you.
Now, let's just jump over here real quick, and we had people calling in, and we're going to get to some of your calls. Let's say hello to Tim. Tim called in to share his points of view on the questions earlier from New Jersey. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Doing great. Thank you.
Good. One worthy mention is Mohandas Gandhi said there's enough for every man's need, but not enough for every man's greed. I think that tells a great deal.
Yes.
About our problems that we have. I think that Alan Greenspan and all the other market manipulating people, we ought to find some way to have them held responsible for the things they've done. This notion of people having the equivalent of diplomatic immunity, I think, is preposterous, and it's led to all this corruption that exists.
Unless we all had the same diplomatic immunity, if
right.
All of us were given a get out of jail free card, so if you broke into a bank, if you robbed a liquor store, if you beat someone, if you hit and run, and you could say, hey, you can't arrest me because you didn't arrest all these other people. If we have one standard of law, then fine, but we don't. You and I are held to a standard of law that no one in power is held to. That's the problem we have. I appreciate your input on that, Tim. Thank you. And I would agree with you on that. Now, joining me in the studio, I'm not in the studio, I'm out filming, is Jason. Hi, Jason.
Good afternoon, Gary. How are you?
Good. Jason, let me just quickly mention, because I didn't have a chance yesterday, I believe that we are now at a unique place where we can collectively stand up and make positive change in our society. In fact, it had to get this bad with massive endemic corruption of both the Democrats and Republicans, with few exceptions on both sides, but there are a few exceptions, they're pro-nuclear. The media is pro-nuclear. The scientific community is pro-nuclear. And as a result, they have gotten every single thing they've wanted. They've gotten the big lies out. Nuclear's green. It's not. It's safe. It's not. It's cost-effective. It's not. And it doesn't pollute the environment. It does. So finally, I have produced a vehicle that we can use to educate the world public. It's a documentary called Knocking on the Devil's Door, A Nuclear Nightmare. On September 21st in New York City at 7 p.m. till 10 p.m., we're going to show the film in its entirety, the new director's cut, which is my cut. I just finished filming last week in Boston, Carl Grossman. And then after that, we have coming from India, Dr. Vandana Shiva, arguably the Gandhi of India today, a remarkable human being. And then we also have Greg Palast and a whole group of people are going to speak out. Plus, we have satellite feeds from around the world giving you the latest and whistleblowers. It's going to be, I only have room for 800 people in the theater, and it will fill up because just Vandana Shiva, just by herself on a stage, draws 2,000 people. Everyone's going to get two copies of the film. Plus, watch the film. Now, if you've already seen the film, A, you can watch it again because there's new material, or B, you can come for the lectures by Vandana Shiva and the other people. And that's where we're going to be giving you the information how we can locally do everything humanly possible. And we have all this information to close down nuclear plants in the United States. We're going to focus on Indian Point, and I want people to know, join us there and call this number. What is the number? It's 877-627-5065. Again, 877 627-5065. And it's $25. I've rented out the space. We've got everything going on. This will be one worldwide effort. We have over 400 environmental organizations. We have over 1,100 environmental journalists. We have every member of every state legislature in America, every governor, 7,000 members of the media, all getting copies of the film before then. So we will have an educated public going forward. It's important that if you at all care about making a difference, you can. But it takes information, organization, and all of us going forward together. And I'm also going to show people what they can do at the grassroots level everywhere in the world. So again, September 21st, Ethical Culture Center, New York City, 7 to 10 p.m., full showing of the film, plus a panel. And again, that number to call, because it's going to fill up, 877-627-5065. Jason, over to you.
Hey, well, speaking of growing, I want to tell you about last night's commentary hour at 7 p.m. We had 36,096 people download that show just from yesterday night. It's an amazing. It's our number one show. It's never gone that well, so I'm very impressed. Wanted to let you know that.
Thank you.
Also, with that being said, we're also expanding, and you can get our podcast on StitcherNow.com, S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R. Just have to put in whatever show you like. Go to Progressive Commentary, their page, and we have all our shows there for you to download. So it's a great... Plus, with just that being said, we have three new shows that are starting, so I just want people to know. No One's Listening with Irene McGee, Fridays at 2 p.m., The Michael Parente Show, which is starting shortly, and Project Uncensored, which will be on Saturdays with Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips.
Plus the Progressive News Hour and the Progressive Minds Hour.
And we have
Gerald Salante, and there'll be... six rotating hosts, some of the greatest minds in America. And then we have the Progressive Economist Hour. Michael Hudson, a lot of people going to be filling in there. So we all told we have almost 37 new programs coming your way because we are inundated with people wanting to hear because we are the fastest growing internet station in the world. And just last night, 36,000 downloads overnight of the Progressive Commentary Hour. That was part two, which is a total of 3 hours now on In the Name of a special I did, investigative reporting special called In the Name of Freedom, Peace, and Democracy, our real motives for going in to countries around the world. And then last night I talked about Operation COINTELPRO, the CIA, the FBI, surveillance in the United States, the Patriot Act, Homeland Security Act, and how these are all meant to take away our rights. And I'm surprised that people have not paid attention to how many rights they have that are being usurped. And like taking away our right to take vitamins, taking away our right to grow organic produce. All this is being done right now. And then one day people wake up and say, gee, you mean I can't buy that? No, you couldn't. When you could, you didn't pay attention. It wasn't important to you. And now it is. Why do you think I'm doing more of the shows that I am doing now on issues around the world, on Wall Street? Because I did not hear progressive voices in the mainstream or in the media talking on these. And that's why I believe it's important now that we have forums for progressive minds. So that's it. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. Stay tuned for our next program and have a nice day, everyone.
The Gary Null Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matthew Bogart. All shows are archived by Kyle Pollard. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Jason Tabenfeld.